Well, hello, and a very good afternoon to one and all. Welcome to What's Cooking for September 2014. I hope I find you all well, and as usual, ready to enjoy today's programme. We have a full-packed show today, so let's ask, what's cooking? Now, I'm sure most of you, if not all of you, are aware that this year is the centenary of the First World War. And so today I thought we'd take a look at the food of the time. I'll give you some of the popular recipes of the time, and I'll also share with you a couple of rather interesting articles that I found. In Britain, during the First World War, 1914 to 1918, queues for food had become dangerously long. A Ministry of Food was created to help with the home front food situation, and rationing was introduced, starting with sugar in December 1917, then with meat and butter in February 1918. The government congratulated itself on its measures, and the Ministry of Food was dissolved on the 31st of March 1921. In truth, though, it wasn't a great success. As the ration coupons were often useless, as the supply of items just wasn't there to meet even that coupon-limited demand. The cost of food more than doubled during the war years. Some prices went up even more than that. A pint of milk cost a penny in the early 1900s. Just after the war, people were expected to pay sixpence a pint. Bread and flour were very hard to get. By 1916, bread was being made from ground-up turnips. The new Ministry for Food put out a leaflet with ideas for making pastry, cakes and buns from potatoes, and even chocolate potato biscuits. As the fighting dragged on, fresh fruit, vegetables and meat got harder to find. There were even stories of butchers selling dead cats. Mothers had to be inventive in the kitchen. Wartime cookbooks had ideas for food like potted cheese. Leftover crumbs of cheese mixed with mustard and margarine, baked in the oven and served with biscuits or toast. Another recipe used cooked fish, rice and breadcrumbs to make fish sausages. The Win the War cookbook carried this message. Women of Britain, our soldiers are beating the Germans on land. Our sailors are beating them on the sea. You can beat them in the larder and the kitchen. In 1918, Britain brought in a system of rationing, where what food there was got shared out more fairly. Everyone was given a ration book that showed how much food they were allowed to buy, including sugar, meat, flour, butter, margarine and milk. Even King George and Queen Mary had ration books. Richer families discovered what it was like to go hungry. Some of the poorest families, however, found rationing left them better fed than before the war. Wartime also produced some new foods: dried soup powder and custard that just needed water adding. There was even a recipe to make Christmas pudding using egg substitute. Food for soldiers in the trenches during World War I was at times considered a luxury. Getting decent hot food from the field kitchens to the frontline trenches could be impossible when a battle was either imminent or in full flow. When soldiers were at stand down, food was easier to acquire, and both British and German troops could expect certain food to be available with a degree of frequency. And now we're going to hear how chocolate was made in the First World War, and this is specifically chocolate for the troops in the trenches, made at the famous Cadbury factory in Bourneville, Birmingham, here in the UK.
Cadbury is one of the most famous companies in the West Midlands. It was founded in Birmingham in 1824, and when the First World War broke out, it did its bit for the war effort. The government put in huge orders for chocolate to supply troops with dairy milk and tins of cocoa. Tony Billsborough from Cadbury told me how the war affected production.
At the start of the war, we were making something like 700 lines of chocolate, more than 700 lines of chocolate here, which is a phenomenal amount. It is very varied. But within 2 years, we'd had to streamline the business so that there were less than 200 lines being made here in Bourneville.
Men and women were employed at the Bourneville factory in equal measure.
I think a lot of people, when they think of a factory, they think of it's very male-dominated. And, of course, the First World War is well known as a time when women started coming into factories. But actually, Cadbury, because of the nature of its work, a lot of the products were handmade. Really, from the earliest days, there was a 50-50 split in the workforce here between men and women. And that continued through the war, and that continues really today.
Barry Timm's mother and father both worked at Cadbury. His mother, Sissy, and her sisters were some of the women employed there. A photograph from the era shows them at work.
On the left-hand side, we've got my mother, Sarah Ann. It looks as if the raw material that my Aunt Emily is holding is for hats or scarves, which appear to be very, very popular with the troops. But my two other aunts appear to be knitting. In the background, there are piles of parcels, apparently ready to go, all with the labels on, to go to the troops wherever.
The Bourneville Works magazine, February 1916. At Christmas, the firm sent a special gift box to every wounded sailor and soldier at home or abroad. Hundreds of acknowledgements have been received from hospitals in all the theatres of war. The firm also sent a Christmas present to all our own men engaged in the Army and Navy of a £1 packet of Mexican chocolate. And in response to this, numerous letters have been received.
The chocolate came in just as we were going into the trenches, so you can see how much it was appreciated.
In the trenches on Christmas Day, where I was up to my neck in water, I soon found time to get out of it quick to see what was waiting
here. You would not wonder why Cadbury's is world-renowned.
And I shared it round. It was half gone before I tasted it, and I did enjoy it.
2,148 Cadbury workers served during the war, among them Barry's father. The company sent chocolate to the men serving overseas.
Over the course of the war, I think we sent up something like 20,000 parcels to not only to our employees and more than 1,000 people left the factory here to go and fight in the war, but also to those who were wounded, whether in the Army, the Navy, in the military hospitals. And it says here on the inside, Christmas 1914, it's headed. And it says, with hearty Christmas greetings to the wounded soldiers and sailors, and with best wishes for their speedy recovery from Cadbury Brothers Limited, Bourneville.
As an employee, Barry's father, Ernie, was one of the recipients of the chocolate.
He was very appreciative of it. I think he had to share quite a lot of stuff with some of his mates. Now, they had parcels at Christmas, parcels at other times, and they shared them out.
Britain may have been at war, but Cadbury was still creating new lines of chocolate.
Well, of course, it's a business, yeah. I mean, and we had to continue to try and survive. Interestingly, in 1915, we launched a brand called Milk Tray, which is still very much with us. So even then, they were innovating, they were trying out new experiments, they were changing it. Milk Tray was not the fancy chocolates you got from the end of the Victorian and the Edwardian period. It's a box of chocolates for the man and woman in the street.
But by 1917, the effect of the war was being felt.
The Bourneville Works magazine, August 1917. The firm, at the request of the government, are installing a vegetable drying plant. The new industry will include fruit pulping and drying. No time is being lost in bringing the new project to reality. Probably about 80 girls will be employed there this year, and it's anticipated that the industry will develop considerably. The importance of fruit and vegetable preservation has never been so fully realised as now.
Primarily, we were seeing shortages of sugar. And you see, towards the end of the First World War, the influence of the U-boats, the German submarines, were taking their toll on some shipping raw materials coming in from the West Indies. So we actually stopped making dairy milk in 1917, and it didn't appear back again until maybe 1 or 2 years after the end of the First World War. That's not just about the sugar, that's about the milk itself, because dairy milk, obviously, it's the milk is almost as important as the cocoa and the sugar. And in fact, the Cadbury brothers sent out a note in towards the end of the war saying that they were actually diverting 20,000 gallons of milk every week, which should have been going to chocolate production, and they sent it from their farms directly to the people of Birmingham, because by that stage shortages were really kicking in, so they diverted the milk from the chocolate manufacturer to the people of Birmingham.
And you had to diversify as well under government orders, didn't you?
We did. There was also other need for other resources as well, so we got into the manufacturing of dried vegetables, of fruit pulp. Utilising the workforce and the facilities here to try and help the British war effort.
And one more thing was produced as a result after Sissy and Ernie got married in 1924.
Both being churchgoers, I think they had known one another before Dad went in the army. And I think their relationship was cemented at the church social for returning a serviceman in 1919. And I am the result.
Our first recipe today is for Apple Brown Betty. This was an economical dish making use of stale or leftover bread. Both summer pudding and bread and butter pudding are from the same tradition. A Betty is a baked pudding. This dish became very popular in colonial America, but also remained a common dish in England. There are many variations using fruits that were in season at different times, and omitting more expensive ingredients like the spices and raisins. For this recipe, you will need 2 apples weighing 1 to 2 pounds each, or 1 kilogram of apples or other fruit in season. 8 ounces, 200 grams, fresh white breadcrumbs, about 6 slices. 5 ounces, 120 grams, brown sugar. 3 ounces, 75 grams, butter. 5 ounces, 120 grams, raisins or sultanas. Grated rind of 1 lemon. 2 to 3 tablespoons lemon juice. Grated nutmeg or cinnamon to flavour. That's less than 1 teaspoon. A generous pinch. And
this is what you do.
1. Preheat the oven to 375 degrees F, 190 degrees C, gas mark 5. 2. Peel, core, and thinly slice the apples. 3. Grease a medium-sized oven-proof dish. 4. Put 1/3 of the breadcrumbs in the bottom and dot with some of the butter. 5. Put 1/2 the apples on top. 6. Sprinkle with 1/2 the sugar, lemon rind, lemon juice, raisins and nutmeg or cinnamon. 7. Put 1/3 of the breadcrumbs on top and dot with more of the butter. 8. Put on the rest of the apples, sugar, etc. 9. Cover with remaining breadcrumbs. Dot the top with the rest of the butter. 10. Cook for about 40 minutes until the apples are tender and the top is golden brown. Next, we're going to hear about baking bread, and this is baking bread for soldiers in the trenches. And I found this one very interesting because it comes from a bakery in the city where I now live. Most of you will know that I live in the city of Peterborough in the UK. And this is from Manor Drive, Peterborough.
Incoming!
As Napoleon famously said, an army marches on its stomach. And in 1914, a soldier's daily ration included a pound of bread. And it was portable bread ovens made at the Westwood Works in the north of Peterborough that kept our boys going.
Right! Now when you wake up, you get to move on!
They did work out how many calories a soldier would need to fight. And this 1 pound loaf of bread, plus everything else they were given, they had meat and potato. And it was all calculated to be enough for them to survive on to be able to fight.
The steam baking system invented and patented by Baker Perkins is still used today. At the Hampleton Bakery in Rutland, artisan baker Paul White explained how it works.
The steam pipe ovens had distilled water that was hermetically sealed into a long rod that would have run all the length of the oven from front to back. They would have placed them above the bread baking surface, so in the top of the loaf, and then underneath the plate of the oven, or the sole plate of the oven. So you'd get constant heat away from the actual fire source. And the idea was that it would heat the pipe, it would heat the water, and the water would heat the rest of the pipe, and that would bake the bread.
At the start of World War I, hundreds of cast metal ovens, dubbed Polly Perkins by soldiers in past wars, left Westwood Works by rail, destined for the Western Front, where the demand for fresh bread on the front line was constant.
I think they promised every man in the trench a 1 pound loaf of bread a day. Whether they achieved it or not, I don't know, but I know one bakery could make 20,000 loaves of bread in a day and send that down the line.
The long tube-shaped ovens with a vertical vent pipe didn't produce anything fancy, just thousands of simple white loaves.
It would have been very similar to what we call our crusty round. Apart from the cuts, they didn't bother to cut it. Obviously, they wanted to get as many out as they could. I think they had one officer and about 90 bakers per bakery. These would be the bakeries that would just be behind the lines. So obviously, they wanted to keep it simple. And so it would just be a round one on the bottom of the oven.
Horses were used to pull the ovens mounted on wooden carriages right onto the battlefield. But it could then take days to deliver to the waiting troops. Sometimes they took matters into their own hands.
Trouble is, it took 5 days to go from the bakery to the trenches. Some of the soldiers, they would make their own ovens, almost build their own ovens on site, and make some of their own bread as well.
The efficiency of the Baker Perkins steam pipe ovens was soon recognised by the Americans, who bought them to supply their own troops. It was the start of what is now a global business, supplying equipment that bakes the supermarket bread we enjoy today.
Next up, we have a recipe for creamed turnips. Adding cream to vegetables is the origin of the term creamed. Seems fairly obvious. We tend to use a lot less fat in our cooking and so would now use a little milk, preferably semi-skimmed, when making creamed potatoes. This is a rich dish using cream to bring out the flavour of the turnips. It is delicious and might be nice for a real treat. And for this, you will need 4 to 6 turnips, a knob of butter, about 1 ounce, that's 25 grams, dash of cream, 1 tablespoon, salt and pepper, and...
This is what you do.
1. Wash, then top and tail the turnips. 2. Peel and roughly slice or dice the turnips or other winter vegetables. 3. Add to slightly salted water and simmer until just tender for about 8 to 10 minutes. 4. Strain in a colander. 5. Mash with up to a tablespoon of cream. 6. Season with salt and pepper. 7. You might also dress the dish with chopped parsley or chervil. And here's a very famous recipe which the soldiers used to make in the trenches. And this is trench stew. This recipe is based on the recollections of a soldier from the 9th Bedfordshire Regiment who served in the trenches during World War I. And as we said earlier, getting fresh hot food from the field kitchen to the front lines was impossible when a battle was raging. Soldiers lucky enough to have a small stove or even candles would boil up any food, including stale biscuits, or add these to the canned food provided. And when I talk about stale biscuits, I am talking about cookies. I know there are those of you in the US who know biscuits as bread rolls, or what we call bread rolls, but I really am talking about cookies. Remember, they had to eat whatever food they had, and this recipe definitely uses cookies. So for this, you will need 1 turnip, 2 carrots, half a tin of corned beef, 1 stock cube, improves flavour. The canned stews and soups would have some flavourings. However, we are not sure if this would have been available in the field kitchens in times of shortages. 1 or 2 biscuits, optional. 1 pint of water. And
this is what you do.
1. Put the water on to boil. 2. Slice up the turnip and carrot. 3. Add to the boiling water. 4. Add the stock and stir, then leave for 10 minutes. 5. Mash up the corned beef and add to the mixture. 6. Add the biscuits and stir. Our final recipe today is for trench cake, and this is baked to the original wartime recipe and is brought to us by Francis Quinn, who some of you may know as the winner of last year's Great British Bake Off. Trench cake is a type of fruit cake with limited ingredients, reflecting food shortages at the time.
I think the trench cake's really relevant at the moment, not just the fact that we're commemorating World War One, but also the fact that there seems to be such a big baking boom as well going on. So the two are coming together with this, and it's not just sort of enjoying the end product, but it's sort of the whole lead up and the journey to it. To start off with, you take 225 grams. Now the recipe says plain flour, but you can use that, that's fine. But you can equally use self-raising flour, which will maybe help it rise a little better. So whatever you've got in your cupboard, because I think this is the whole point about the trench cake. They didn't obviously have a lot in their cupboard at the time. So 225 grams. Let's get the last bits. Waste not, want not. And then we've got 210 grams of margarine here. And again, if you wanted to, you could use butter. But obviously margarine was a little bit easier to come by. And then just with my fingers, I'm just going to mix this into the flour. So it will start to move to like breadcrumby texture. And then we're going to add in 75 grams of brown sugar. Just going in there. And also 75 grams of currants or raisins. So I think it's just finding, using the basic recipe as the sort of building block, but then using what flavours and sugars you might have in your cupboards. And then spice-wise, you need half a teaspoon of ground nutmeg and half a teaspoon of ground ginger. And then 2 teaspoons of cocoa powder, which I found, I was like, well, that's not a lot. You could, if you wanted it a bit more chocolatey, add some more in. Or like I said, if you're not a fan of raisins and you want to use chocolate chips, then that's going to make it even more chocolatey. And then 1/2 teaspoon of lemon zest going in there. So that's the rest of the dry ingredients. And I'm just going to mix that round here. So the brown sugar will make it sort of quite nice and treacly. So that's all mixed together then. And then we've got 150 mils of milk. And this is the bit of unusual thing. We add 1 teaspoon of vinegar. I've got apple cider vinegar here, but you could use white wine vinegar. Red wine, I wouldn't recommend. So pop that in. And then 1/2 teaspoon of bicarbonate of soda. So that's, I think, going to help give it a little bit of a rise. And then all you need to do is literally just pour that into the dry ingredients. And then I've just got a spatula here just to sort of work it together. It's quite a loose batter. So now you can bake it in a round tin, like the sort of traditional sort of one I did here. I just lined it and then did it that way. So we've got a small one in this little individual size tin, but it can also be baked in cupcake cases. And you want to bake, whether they're this shape or slightly larger tin, I'd say about 160 fan, 170 if it's not fan. They'll probably take about 20 minutes. This cake has made me delve into my own family history and find out more about my great-granddad, who fought in the First World War I, and I discovered that he spent quite a bit of time in India. So I've added coconut milk instead of milk, and I've swapped the nutmeg for cardamom. I think it's things like that that makes it relevant to today. And as well as when you're baking it, it's then once it's baked and sitting down and discussing it again more in more detail. I think it makes it more memorable as well. It's not just your stomach that's getting full, but it's your head full of history and facts, and for you to then be able to pass down as well. I think it can be grown-ups through to young children that sort of make the cake and also discuss it.
If you have queries, questions, ideas for future programmes, recipes you would like to share with other listeners, etc., you can do so by emailing cooking@theglobalvoice.info. That's cookin@theglobalvoice.info. To download or to listen to this programme again, go to theglobalvoice.info/gallery. Or you can go to incx.org, where you can subscribe to the What's Cooking podcast. Well, I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. I hope you've enjoyed the show as much as I have presenting it. I did find that one very interesting to research, I must admit. This is Sue Hadfield saying, look after yourselves and each other. And as always, happy cooking!